Plaintiffs may call their next witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. Plaintiffs call Professor Mark Jacobson.
Your Honor, before Dr. Jacobson testifies on the record, I wanted to clarify whether permitting his testimony means the court has denied our motion limiting number two, which sought to exclude witnesses that we thought were not relevant, and we specifically briefed Dr. Jacobson's testimony.
If I may, Your Honor, the court's order on the state's motion limiting number two, where the state sought to exclude Dr. Jacobson's testimony about renewable energy, states, quote, testimony about renewable energy and the feasibility of Montana shifting away from fossil fuels is relevant to the strict scrutiny analysis and will be allowed. Both parties on this issue and denied the motion.
Yes, I have.
And before we get started, Your Honor, with Professor Jacobson, I'm going to be referring, and I'm sorry for these aren't in consecutive numerical order, Exhibit P-191, Professor Jacobson's CV, Exhibit P-68, paper on zero air pollution, Exhibit P-162, Exhibit P-312, Attachment 6 to Professor Jacobson's expert report, Exhibit P-13, Attachment 2 to Professor Jacobson's expert report, Exhibit 314, it references attachment to his rebuttal report. Exhibit P37, his Montana energy policy study. Exhibit P9, understanding energy in Montana. Exhibit P118, on the causal link between carbon dioxide and air pollution mortality. And Exhibit P42, paper on 100% clean and renewable wind, water, and sunlight. Your Honor, I may have misspoke and said 113 instead of 313.
13? Would you maybe, I would have written it down as 13.
I heard
313. So was it P313?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And Dr. Lori Byron, when she testified of his copy of Exhibit 312, so in case he forgets the numbers, and with a copy of Jacobson to ask the court, so that the record Professor Jacobson, could you please state your full name?
Yeah, MARZA.
On climate change.
Yes, it does.
What did you do your PhD dissertation on?
I developed and applied a computer model to simulate and study air pollution in the Los Angeles basin. So gas, aerosol, transport, and radiation. And so I accounted for gas, aerosols, transport, and radiation, and meteorology and the weather to try to predict air pollution changes over time and in the Los Angeles basin and compare those changes of air pollution concentrations in the air with actual data.
And did you also attempt to determine the effect on human health?
Yes. Subsequently, that's the same model I used to examine the health impacts of air pollutants emitted from fossil fuels and biofuels on human health.
Professor Jacobson, starting with after you received your PhD from UCLA, can you describe your work history?
Yes, in September 1994, I started as an assistant professor at Stanford University in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. In 2001, I obtained tenure and became an associate professor. And then in 2007, I became a full professor, and I'm still a full professor at Stanford University. So I've been there about 29 years. And in 2004, I started in the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department. I started a program called the Atmosphere Energy Program, and I've been a director of the undergraduate and graduate program there ever since. In 2007 to 19, well, sorry, it was actually from 2007 to 10, I was also a co-faculty in the Energy Resources Engineering Department by courtesy. From 2008 to today, I've been a senior fellow of the Woods Institute for the Environment. From 2010 to today, I've been a senior fellow of the Precourt Institute for Energy. And in 2011, this was outside of Stanford, I co-founded a nonprofit called the Solutions Project.
Briefly, can you describe what the Solutions Project is?
Yes, the Solutions Project, well, originally we developed, or I developed energy plans with, ultimately with students and also people at other universities. We developed energy plans for states and eventually countries, but particularly for U.S. states, the Solutions Project would then take these energy plans and we try to educate the public and policymakers about them, to give more information about a transition to renewable energy.
Can you please explain the research you have done since you started teaching at Stanford?
Yes, I've continued to develop models, computer models, to simulate air pollution, weather, and climate. So since my PhD, I expanded the urban air pollution computer model that I developed, which was actually at the time that was only the third air pollution model in the world. And I expanded that to build my own climate model, build it up to the global scale, and to study not only global climate, but the impacts of air pollutants on climate and the feedbacks of air, of climate back to air pollution. And then I developed a computer model that simulates all scales in between the global and the local scale. Also, I've studied, I started developing roadmaps in 2009 to transition states, countries, cities, and towns, and affect the whole world to 100% clean renewable energy and storage for everything.
In terms of your work, your research, what happened in the year 2015?
Well, most relevant events, we published two papers in 2015. One was a paper, a roadmap paper for each of the 50 United States. It was really looking at what, how we could transition each state in 2050 to 100% renewables. And so we looked at the how much wind, how much solar, how many wind turbine solar panels, et cetera, we might need. And anyway, we developed a roadmap for each state. And then we also did a second paper, which was a grid stability analysis to see if it was possible to keep the contiguous U.S. Stable with 100% renewables across all states.
Since your 2015 paper was published, have you done an update to that paper for all 50 states in the United States? And here I'm displaying exhibit P68.
Yes, in 2022, we published a paper. It was an updated paper actually combining both the roadmaps and the grid stability analysis for all 50 states. And in this case, we actually did the grid stability analysis by region and also for several individual states as if they were islanded from other states. So to see if certain states could be 100, have a stable grid with 100% renewables without being interconnected with other states.
And was this 2022 version of the paper peer-reviewed?
Yes, it was.
Did you also publish a peer-reviewed paper, Low-Cost Solutions to Global Warming, Air Pollution, and Energy Insecurity for 145 Countries, in Energy and Environmental Sciences, also in 2022?
Yes, we did.
And both papers were peer-reviewed?
Yes.
Why did you update and republish your peer-reviewed paper from papers from 2015 to 2022?
Well, since 2015, a lot has changed. The amount of energy consumed in each state and country, in fact, has changed. The cost of renewable energy has changed. The amount, the installations of renewable energy have changed. And so one thing is just to update all the information because people want to know, and policymakers, some are relying on the, this type of information, so we wanted to update the information. In addition, more deposed to the U.S. as a whole.
Have you published in your career?
6 books and almost 180 peer-reviewed journal articles.
What book did you publish in 2020?
This book, 100% Clean Renewable Energy and Storage for Everything, was published by Cambridge University Press.
And what's your most recent published book?
This is called No Miracles Needed. It was also published by Cambridge University Press.
And essentially, how does No Miracles Needed differ from your prior book?
Well, the prior book, the 2020 book, was really a textbook for mostly for students, and it had a lot of details of equations and figures and a lot of more esoteric information. This newer book is more of a general layman's book. Had also updated information in the last 3 years since 2020, but it was more general audience.
Can you briefly explain what an atmospheric model is?
Yes, so an atmospheric model tries to represent what's actually going on in the atmosphere. So there are many physical phenomena occurring in the atmosphere, such as cloud formation, winds, meteorology, winds, sunlight coming to the surface, heat radiation leaving the Earth's surface. You have emissions, you have transport of the emissions, you have chemical reactions occurring in the atmosphere due to sunlight hitting chemicals and converting them, or chemicals hitting each other and turning into different chemicals. And you have gases that get dissolved in cloud drops. You have gases that turn into particles. Then you have gases and particles that get removed from the atmosphere. Anyway, an atmospheric model first represents each of these physical processes with a set of pure equations. And then you try to distill those equations into equations that a computer model can actually solve numerically. And then, so you're actually trying to predict what's actually happening in the real world. And that's what a model does. It tries to predict what's happening, and then you have output, and then you compare with data to validate it.
Another term you've used in your testimony is the term roadmap. Can you explain what a roadmap is?
Well, in the context of our work, it's really, we're looking at a future date, such as 2050, and we're trying to determine, is it possible to transition the energy infrastructure of a given region, such as state, a country, a city, a town, or it could even be a company, to entirely clean renewable energy. And so we start with the current energy infrastructure, we project it forward to a future date, and then we convert that energy infrastructure into mostly electricity, and then come up with a set of clean renewable energy resources that can meet that electricity demand in 2050. And once we come up with that estimate, and we base that estimate not only on the local resources of the region or state, but also other constraints, we then estimate, well, what are the costs of energy? How much land is required? What are the air pollution cost savings? What are the climate cost savings? What are the changes in employment that result from this new infrastructure?
So speaking generally, how do you go about developing a roadmap to meet the energy needs of a state?
Well, we start with current energy consumption in a state, and in the case of the U.S. states, the energy data comes from the Energy Information Administration, also called the EIA, and they provide energy in 4 sectors: residential, commercial, industrial, and transportation. And each of those sectors, there's a different fuel type used. There's a bunch of different fuel types that are used, such as oil, coal, gas, renewables, electricity, which is considered one of their subsectors. And then for each of those fuel types in each sector, we use EIA projections to project those fuels forward to 2050 in what's called a business as usual, or BAU case, which is a case with modest economic growth, some energy efficiency improvements, some renewables, but not a lot. And so that's a business as usual case for 2050. Then at that point, we do a conversion of all that energy to electricity and some heat, and then provide that electricity and heat with just what we call wind, water, and solar, which includes onshore and offshore wind, solar photovoltaics on rooftops and power plants, concentrated solar power, geothermal electricity and heat, hydroelectricity, some in small amounts of tidal and wave power where it's relevant.
So a couple of follow-up questions there. First, you refer to the EIA. Quickly, what's the EIA?
It's the Energy Information Administration that provides data. Well, there's a lot of things that provides data for our studies.
And in terms of your models, are you targeting a specific year?
Well, 2050 has been the end year of all our roadmap to date.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your area of research relating to understanding the effects of air pollution?
Yes, I have been developing computer and applying computer models since 1989, so on the order of 34 years, to study air pollution and its impact on human health and the environment and feedback of air pollutants in the global climate system as well.
When did you first publish in the field of air pollution and its impact on human health?
Well, I'd say the first publication that actually related to air pollution was in 1994.
As a result of all that work, have you won any awards?
Yes. Some of the major ones in 2005, I received an American Meteorological Society Henry G. Houghton Award for my role on modeling black carbon, which is the main component of soot, and the discovery that black carbon may be the second leading cause of global warming after carbon dioxide. And in 2013, the American Geophysical Union awarded an ASCENT Award for the same finding. In 2013, I received a Global Lit Green Policy Design Award, which was for our work on developing energy plans, in this case for the state of New York. In 2016, that paper where we did the grid integration study for the contiguous United States received a Cozzarelli Prize from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which is a prize given to 6 out of 16,000 papers submitted each year to the journal. In 2018, I received a Judy Friedman Lifetime Achievement Award for my work on studying computer modeling of particles in particular, but also renewable energy plans. In 2022, I received a Clean Tech Influencer of the Year Award. And in 2022, there was an evaluation where I was ranked as the most impactful scientist in the world in the field of meteorology and atmospheric sciences for papers first published after 1985. And number 6 in the world in the field of energy for papers published starting after 1980.
And going back to your renewable energy roadmaps, have they been used by local, state, or even the federal government?
Yes, the roadmaps we've developed, particularly for the 50 United States, but also our world country roadmaps, have been used as a scientific basis of several laws and proposed laws in 19 U.S. states and 180 U.S. cities and several proposed laws at the federal level, 8 proposed laws in the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate, and also several laws internationally.
Have you even been, as a result of your research, on the cover of Scientific American?
Yes, in 2009, our first paper evaluating whether it was possible to transition the whole world to 100% clean renewable energy was published in Scientific American. And by then, the question was, could we do it by 2030? And the answer was, well, it's technically and economically possible, but for social and political reasons, it's probably more likely by 2050.
Have you previously written up a summary of the plan for Montana that was marked as Exhibit 312?
Yes, sir. The paper in 2022 on U.S. states, we developed a plan for Montana.
And am I displaying, if this is Attachment 6 to your research report of what I earlier referred to as Exhibit 312, is this, in essence, the part of your roadmap that relates to Montana?
Yeah, so this is a summary. This wasn't the actual published paper, but it's a summary of what's in the published paper of our Montana energy plan.
So just to quickly restate, you had a paper that covered all 50 United States, but for purposes of your work in this case, you broke out Montana, in essence.
Well, we developed documents like this for all 50 states, and this is the Montana summary from that paper.
Okay. Have you testified before Congress on these issues?
Yes, in 2005, I testified in the U.S. House of Representatives Subcommittee on Energy and Resources on comparing wind energy with nuclear energy. In 2007, in the U.S. House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform on the role of black carbon as a factor of climate change. In 2008, in the House of Representatives Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming, I testified on the relative impact of carbon dioxide and air pollution, health problems in California versus in the rest of the U.S. In 2015, in the House of Representatives Energy Commerce Committee, I testified on powering the 50 United States and 139 countries with 100% wind, water, and solar for all purposes.
Have you been invited to testify or present before any other governmental bodies?
Yes, I've testified in front of the Environmental Protection Agency twice.
Have you served on a committee at the invitation of the Secretary of the United States Department of Energy?
Yes.
Notwithstanding all of that, is this the first time you're testifying as a witness in a courtroom as an expert in a case?
Yes.
Do you believe that your testimony will be helpful in assisting the court to understand the evidence in this case?
I do.
Are you charging the youth plaintiffs in this case for any of your time serving as an expert witness?
No, I am not.
In preparing your testimony in this case, did you consult any written resources?
Yes.
Your Honor, we've marked as Exhibit 313 the portion of Professor Jacobson's expert report containing a list of citations. And Professor Jacobson is Exhibit 313, the documents you considered in forming your opinions.
Yes, there are some of them.
And, Your Honor, we've also marked as Exhibit 314 the similar set of references for his rebuttal report. And are these documents you considered in forming your opinions as to your rebuttal report?
Yes.
Your Honor, I'd move in Exhibits 313 and 314.
No objection.
P313 and P314 are necessary.
And Professor Jacobson, Exhibit 312, the document we displayed earlier, Attachment 6, contains a copy of the Montana roadmap that you're going to testify about today. Is that correct?
Yes.
Your Honor, I'd move Exhibit 312 into evidence.
No objection.
312 is admitted.
Professor Jacobson, were all the opinions expressed in your expert disclosures based on a reasonable degree of scientific certainty?
Yes.
And will you please answer my questions today using that same standard, a reasonable degree of scientific certainty?
Yes, I will.
Your Honor, based on the testimony Professor Jacobson's provided, I hereby tender him as an expert in the areas he outlined he'll be covering.
Yes, I agree he's an expert.
Thank you. And, Professor Jacobson, let's start explaining the background for the work you did for this case. Can you explain the different energy sectors you look at for your renewable energy transition plans?
Yeah, the four main sectors that the EIA also considers are the residential, commercial, industrial, and transportation sectors. So within each sector, there are different fuels used and different energy sources. And so we look at each fuel type within each of these four sectors.
And in your field, just to be clear on a little bit on terminology, is total energy consumption in Montana the same thing as end-use energy in Montana?
Yes.
Let's put up a pie graph. This chart is headed sources of all purpose energy consumed in Montana, 2018. So with reference to this graph, what's the current makeup of energy consumed in Montana?
Yeah, this is all energy. So all energy consumption, that is, not production, but consumption, is primarily fossil fuels, where the main fossil fuels are in order oil, natural gas, and then coal is a smaller portion. And then after that, we have renewables, which are primarily hydropower, and then wind, and then a small amount of solar, and then bioenergy, I separated out. Well, so I say wind, WWS means wind, water, solar, which we look at clean renewable energy. So we do not consider bioenergy as clean. It is renewable, but not clean because you usually burn and that produces air pollution. So it's separated out. WWS renewables do not produce air pollution, and they do not produce greenhouse gas emissions.
Sometimes in the course of your testimony, we're going to differentiate between energy and electricity. So for purposes of this question, does Montana currently produce enough renewable energy to meet its current electricity needs?
Well, according to the latest data from the EIA, which actually might be the very latest, but from, I think it was within the last few months for the previous year, wind, water, solar met 92.6% of Montana's electricity demand consumption. Doesn't mean there wasn't more produced, but hydropower met about 70% of the consumption, wind met 22.5%, and solar met a little less than 1%. So that adds up to 92.6% of the consumed energy you could meet with just wind, water, and solar. Now, there's additional fossil fuel energy beyond the 100% that's also produced, but that's exported.
And in what sectors of Montana is most of the fossil fuel energy being consumed?
Mostly, well, transportation, industry, and in buildings, but not in electricity.
And is there a technical or political reason why fossil fuels supply 75% of the all-purpose energy consumed in Montana, based on your opinion?
I mean, there's no limitation to how much renewable energy Montana has. It has so much renewable energy, it's incredible. There's the only reason you don't have 100% renewable energy for all purposes in Montana, it's only due to legacy that you've historically, there's been a lot of fossil fuel out, and then policies have not been pushed to promote renewable energy.
Professor Jacobson, can you walk us through the steps of displaying a slide called Energy Roadmap Steps? So with reference to this slide, can you walk us through the steps you take in developing these energy transition roadmaps to move off of fossil fuels?
Yeah, our first step is we start with EIA energy consumption data for each of the four sectors and each fuel type in each sector, such as oil, coal, gas, renewables, electricity. And then we project forward to 2050 based on a business as usual scenario. And that projection is based on EIA data as well, to try to estimate for each fuel type in each sector what the energy consumption will be in 2050. And that projection accounts for population growth and natural improvements in efficiency, and some additional renewable energy, but not a lot. And so we get the 2050 number, and then for each fuel type in each energy sector in 2050, we then try to electrify it as much as possible. So we convert it to electricity. For example, if we have gasoline vehicles, we try to convert them first to battery electric vehicles. For long distance transport, we might need some hydrogen fuel cell, long distance planes and ships, for example. And then for like natural gas heating in buildings, we'd go to electric heat pumps. For natural gas stoves, we'd go to electric induction cooktops. Well, okay, so we do this for each fuel type in each sector. Then we come up with the amount of electricity that we'll need. And then with that amount of electricity, we then back calculate, well, how many wind turbines, how many solar panels, and we come up with a mix of wind and solar based on, there's some places where you don't have any wind, there's some places you don't have any solar. So we have a constraint or geo, you might not have, there are only 13 states in the U.S. that have a lot of geothermal electricity potential. So, you know, we'll come up with some mix based on resource constraint of wind, water, solar technologies. Once we come up with that mix, we then calculate, well, how much land will this require? What will it cost in terms of energy cost? What's the change of jobs from the previous infrastructure to the current infrastructure? What's the change of air pollution health costs to reducing fossil fuel and biofuel combustion of pollution to produce pollution? And what is the change of climate costs estimates? Oh, by the way, we also calculate the capital cost of such a transition as well.
Thank you for that explanation. Now, I'm going to display a slide that's captioned "Another Way to Look at Energy." Does this graph depict the ultimate findings in your 2022 paper of the energy transition in Montana to wind, water, and solar?
Yes, this summarizes the 2018 EIA data for total final consumption or end use energy in the state of Montana. It summarizes the projections of 2050 in the business as usual case. And this is across all energy sectors. So it shows oil, gas, biomass, coal, and electricity in all energy sectors in 2018 and 2050. And then it shows what happens when you electrify. And the interesting thing that happens, and this happens everywhere, is when you electrify and provide the electricity with just wind, water, and solar, your energy requirements decrease a lot. Worldwide, it's about 56%. In Montana, it's about 61.4%. And you might ask, why? No.
Why?
So, very, very quickly, for five main reasons. I mean, first of all, 10.5% of all energy in Montana is used to mine, transport, and refine fossil fuels. And with a wind, water, solar system, you don't need that energy at all because wind comes right to the turbine, solar comes right to the panel. You don't need to dig it out of the ground, transport it, refine it. So that's 10.5%. A big portion is due to electrification of transportation. Electric vehicles use about 1/4 the energy as internal combustion engine vehicles. So, for example, we'll explain more in detail later, but just for now, it's 1/4 the energy. An electric heat pump uses about 1/4 the energy as a natural gas heater or even an oil-based heater for combustion or even electric resistance heater. Electric heat pumps are very efficient because they move energy rather than create it. Even an electric induction cooktop stove uses only 40% of the energy as a natural gas stove. So, and then electrifying industry, that's not a big reduction, maybe 4 or 5% reduction due to the efficiency of electrified industry. And then another 6 or 7% of reduction due to end use energy efficiency improvements beyond business as usual. And those all add up to about 61.4% for Montana.
So I'd just like to go back to the graph for a second and just walk through a couple quick points. So there's, in essence, three columns. The left column is where we were, in essence, in 2018. Is that correct?
Correct.
And it breaks out oil, gas, biomass, coal, and electricity in terms of annual energy in gigawatts. Is that correct?
Yes, it's converted to gigawatts.
Okay.
And then, which is a unit of power, by the way.
And then you have here business as usual. So do you, in essence, assume the left-hand column for 2050, they're continuing generally on the same path with some changes? So,
well, yeah, it accounts for population growth, so some increased energy, number of energy devices, but more energy efficiency improvements and some changes in renewable energy.
And then finally, here on the right-hand side, what you're saying is with wind, water, and solar, there can be this 61.4% reduction using the same assumptions as the business as usual. In other words, population growth and the like.
Yes, and this occurs without people changing their habits.
So now I'd like you, we're just talking about the various reasons for wind, water, and solar. What I'd like to do now is break these five reasons out. And the first reason, can you explain what's displayed in this slide on the issue of electric transportation?
Yeah, so a gasoline vehicle, which is an internal combustion engine vehicle, only about 17 to 20% of the energy in the gasoline goes to move the car, and the rest is waste heat. Whereas once you put electricity into a battery electric vehicle, 80% or even up to 90% of the electricity going into the car goes to move the car, and the rest is waste heat. So by going from a gasoline vehicle to an electric vehicle, you reduce by a factor, you reduce to 1/4 the amount of energy you actually need to move a car.
Do you have a specific example that you want to?
Yeah, so this is a good example. This is a 2023 Ford F-150 extended range Lightning. It's four-wheel drive electric vehicle. That's, and compared with a 2023 Ford 150 four-wheel drive, eight-cylinder gasoline vehicle. So it's actually a flex-fuel vehicle that runs on gasoline or E85 ethanol. And it's the Ford 150 electric vehicle, it goes four times the distance per unit energy going into the vehicle than does the gasoline equivalent. And that's reflected in this mileage difference here, that even the Environmental Protection Agency, when they do their vehicle mileage analyses, they publish. And so if you calculate that out, the average person in Montana drives 15,000 miles per year, and over 15 years, which is a typical life of a car, and the price of gasoline in Montana is on the order of $3.25, $3.50 per gallon. It's like $3.25 per gallon. But the price of electricity is about 12 and a half cents per kilowatt hour. And when you actually run the numbers on this, you find that a person driving this electric vehicle will save $35,000 over 15 years driving an electric vehicle. There are 800,000 licensed drivers in Montana, and if everybody drove an electric vehicle in Montana instead of an internal combustion engine vehicle, that includes E85 or gasoline or diesel, Montana, in aggregate, the consumers of Montana would save $30 billion over 15 years. So by continuing with the fossil fuel industry, this is just penalizing and maintaining the requirement or the incentives to continue with gasoline and diesel, really costing citizens of Montana $30 billion over 15 years.
And Professor Jacobson, in this case, we've had some questions about farm equipment, like tractors. Is there technology for electric tractors available today?
Yes, there is.
And what about converting an existing combustion engine tractor to electric? Is that available?
Well, there are electric tractors available. You can switch to electric tractor.
Okay. And how many hours could an electric tractor run on a full charge?
Well, one model I looked at was about 13 hours, 14 hours actually.
And how long does it take to fully charge an electric tractor on average with just a home charger?
Well, the one I looked at, it was about 5.5 hours. So you can do that overnight.
And is it feasible to build out here in Montana the network of charging stations to support that transportation?
Well, charging stations would be more relevant to regular passenger vehicles and trucks and buses on the road. And yes, there are already charging stations. There are supercharging stations in Montana for fast supercharging. You can charge a vehicle in to go an extra 200 to 250 miles in like an hour for Tesla superchargers, for example. But it's very feasible. There's some states that have lots and lots of so many chargers, it's never a problem to get charging. So Montana can do the same thing.
We've covered reason one for converting 100% wind, water, solar. What's the second reason you were wanted to discuss?
Well, so a lot of energy in buildings, in fact, most energy is used to heat water and air, and there's also air conditioning. So electric heat pumps work both for air heating and air conditioning, and there are also electric heat pump water heaters. And as I mentioned before, electric heat pumps, they use about 1/4 the energy as natural gas or other type of combustion heaters because they just move heat around or cold from inside to outside or outside to inside the house or some they're in very cold climates, you might use what's called a ground source electric heat pump, where instead of extracting heat from the air outside the house, you extract it from the ground. And they're also what are called water source heat pumps, where you extract the heat from a water body like a lake or even a swimming pool. And these are very efficient because you're just moving heat around. So they use 1/4 the energy as natural gas heaters, and they end up saving a lot of money, just like electric vehicles do.
And do you have another example?
Yeah, so an electric induction cooktop stove. It's not the same as the electric resistance stove. So electric resistance stoves are those stoves that appear really red when and they actually heat up, the stove heats up. In this case, you need a pot or a pan with either stainless steel or iron base. So in the stove itself, there's an electrical current, and that current induces an electric current in the base of the pot or the pan. So it directly heats the pot or the pan. The pot or the pan becomes hot directly. And so you don't have much waste heat. Whereas you can see a natural gas stove, like on the figure on the right, natural gas stove, you're actually heating the stove. So the stove gets hot, and then you transfer that heat to the pot or the pan. So during that process, a lot of heat is lost. In fact, about 60% of the heat is lost. So going to an electric induction cooktop not only reduces energy needs by a factor of, or by 60%, but it also boils water half the time as natural gas because it's so efficient. And when you touch the stove, you don't burn your hand like you would if you touched a gas stove, because you're not actually heating the stove itself.
So the third reason you wanted to discuss involved industrial uses. Can you explain that?
Well, so a lot of energy in industry is used for high temperature processes. And right now, most of those high temperatures are obtained by burning coal, oil, or natural gas, or sometimes biofuels or biomass. Instead, there are a lot of existing electric technologies, such as electric arc furnaces, electric induction furnaces, electric resistance furnaces, electron beam heaters, and whatnot, even microwaves and also heat pumps that run on electricity. And you can save about 4 to 5% that total energy demand just by electrifying industry. You're not getting as big of a savings because you're still, it's still not as efficient. It's not like a heat pump where you get that much efficiency, but you do get about 4 to 5% benefit.
What about the fourth reason, energy wasted in mining, refining, and transporting fossil fuels?
Yeah, as I mentioned, about 10.5% of all energy in Montana is used just to mine, transport, and refine fossil fuels. In other words, it's energy to obtain energy. And we don't need to do that when we have clean renewable energy like wind, water, and solar, because wind comes right to the panel, solar comes right to the rooftop, wind comes right to the turbine. So as a result, we can save about 10.5% of all energy in Montana by eliminating continuous mining for fuels.
And the fifth reason was energy efficiency improvements. Can you explain the point you want to make there?
Well, this is simply using more energy efficient appliances that are similar to each other. So, for example, going from incandescent lights to LED lights for building heating. I mean, an LED light uses on the order of 1/20th the energy as an incandescent light, and also lasts forever. It doesn't. I mean, I have a home that I built in 2017, and I don't have a single light bulb that's burned out in 6 years. And it's just hard to use any energy. It's just amazing. So refrigerators too. You can have one refrigerator could use like half the energy of another refrigerator, or having a washing machine, or a dishwasher. There are certain energy efficient appliances that just use less energy. So this is about 6.6% of our energy from Montana relies on reducing energy demand beyond in a business as usual case, just by pushing the envelope of energy efficiency in appliances, and also reducing some energy use, like more telecommuting rather than driving to work as much. But that's more voluntary. I mean, that's reducing energy use by is going to only help. I mean, the more people reduce energy use, that'll just make it easier for these plants to work, but they're not a necessary component for the plants to work.
So how will all-purpose Montana energy be met in 2050, according to your work?
Well, the scenario we developed, and there are actually many, many scenarios, so this is just one, is with the end-use energy that for 2050, the resulting energy would be met with mostly wind, existing hydropower. So we're not, in our plans, we do not increase the hydropower output, but there's a lot of hydropower. And then when we actually electrify everything, hydropower is still a good portion of the total. There's utility scale solar, rooftop solar, and also a small amount of geothermal electricity.
So do your roadmaps, ones you're going to be discussing here today, account for all of the projected energy that the United States Energy Information Agency says Montana would need through 2050 without requiring people to conserve or even change behavior?
Yeah, so we started EIA data and we projected using EIA projections. So it was our own numbers, but based on EIA information, are the numbers that we came to are consistent with data that's from EIA's own numbers.
Since you published your plan for Montana, had there been other studies on the availability of wind power in Montana?
Yeah, we completed a study looking at energy resources in wind energy resources over the whole United States and concluded in Montana that there's about over 330 times the wind energy resource that Montana needs to power the state in 2050 for all energy purposes. And so Montana has the third largest wind energy resource in the U.S. after Alaska and Texas, but 330 times the wind energy resources versus what it's needed to power the state for all purposes in 2050.
I'd like to shift now to government conduct that I'm going to call it impedes the transition. In your experience working on renewable energy, are you aware of government obstacles to achieve a renewable energy system?
There are a lot of obstacles in many jurisdictions based on policies that are either designed or inadvertently stymie the efforts to transition to renewable energy.
Your Honor, unless we can tie this testimony to the single statute that's at issue in this case, I'm going to object to relevance.
All right. Well, I think I've already ruled that I think feasibility is an issue, so I'm going to overrule the objection.
Yesterday, I know you weren't in court, Professor Jacobson, but Plaintiff Claire testified that she raised $125,000 to get a solar array installed on her middle school. Claire also testified that she was limited to 50 kilowatts because that is what the maximum amount the state of Montana's laws allow to an entity to install. What effect do those types of installations have on the transition off of fossil fuels to renewable energy?
They slow down the transition and they increase the cost of the transition.
Recently, the legislature passed several bills, Senate Bill 208, and specifically that measure prohibits the department from prohibiting the use of, a state building may not include in the state building code a prohibition of or limitation on the use of electric, natural gas, propane, or other energy source. Will that relate to the testimony you just given about the transition?
That will make it very difficult to transition. If you cannot prohibit natural gas in buildings, for example, then you're ensuring that natural gas stays in buildings and natural gas causes damage to air pollution, causes air pollution, health damage, and climate damage, not only in its use when you burn it, but also during its mining and transport and processing.
In the same legislative session, House Bill 241 prohibits, it says powers denied, and a local government unit is prohibited from any power to require that buildings be constructed to have solar panels. I'm just going to stop there. Is that type of legislation also what you're speaking of?
Yes, that's also, it also slows down a transition or even prevents a transition.
House Bill 241 also, let's turn to Senate Bill 228. That also prohibits a local government from prohibiting the purchase or use of any fuel derived from petroleum. Will that inhibit a transition?
Yes, that would definitely slow down and inhibit a full transition.
Professor Jacobson, I want to turn to the comparative costs of a fossil fuel energy system in all sectors to a wind, water, solar, or renewable energy system. Have you performed an analysis of the cost savings if the state of Montana transitioned from its current energy makeup, as you earlier testified, largely fossil fuels, to an entirely renewable energy system by the year 2050?
Yes.
And are there generally three cost savings, efficiency, death, and harms avoided, and the social cost of carbon that factored into your analysis?
Yeah, there's energy cost savings, health cost savings, and climate cost savings.
So let's start with the first area, efficiencies. Can you explain why there's such a significant reduction in energy costs due to changing energy infrastructure?
Yeah, so we estimate that in the business as usual case, Montana will spend about $9 billion per year in 2050 for their energy. That's for all energy sectors, and that's annual energy payment. But by going to electrifying and going to wind, water, solar for electricity, that will decrease by about 69.6% to $2.8 billion per year.
So if Montanans had 100% wind, water, solar energy system in 2050, they'd be paying $2.8 billion each year for all energy needs rather than $9.1 billion.
Correct.
In addition to the reduction in energy cost savings, how do renewable energy costs compare I moved the slide a little quickly. In addition to reducing energy costs, how do renewable energy costs compare to fossil fuel energy costs today, including coal, oil, and gas?
Okay. Well, to clarify, I think your question is, what's the cause of this? And there are two reasons. One is that, so there's a 69.6% reduction in annual energy costs for two reasons. One is the 61.4% reduction in energy requirements. So even if the cost per unit energy were the same, if you're using 61% less energy, that means the annual energy cost will go down 61%. So that's the most part of it. The rest is the reduction in the cost per unit energy with wind, water, and solar. And that's on the order of about 15%. Right now, new wind and new solar, new onshore wind and utility solar are the lowest cost new forms of electric power throughout the United States. And on the order of half the cost of new natural gas, even less than more than that for compared with new coal. However, when you go to wind, water, solar, you do need more storage. But when you balance the reduction of energy cost, the cost per unit energy due to wind, water, going to wind and solar in particular, with the increase in storage, you still get a net in 2050, we estimate of about 15% lower cost per unit energy of a wind, water, solar system. So combining that with the reduction of power requirements, that's how we get the 69.6% reduction in annual energy cost. And by the way, just one point, that Ford F-150 example, which is $30 trillion over $30 billion over 15 years. Well, divide that by 30 billion by 15 years. That's $2 billion per year. That account, $2 billion per year is right there. It accounts for part of that.
So the second area of cost savings you identified is in avoided deaths and morbidity or illness just from the effect of fossil fuel pollution on human health, not including the climate change health effects. How do you calculate those cost savings?
So we look at, I mean, based on air pollution modeling, we've looked at the health effects of all air pollutants, fossil fuel and biofuel air pollutants in all 50 states, and estimate the number of mortalities and illnesses in each state. And we came up, we did analysis for Montana, and we estimate that, well, we project forward to 2050, that in 2050, there are about still 100, in a business as usual case, still about 130 premature deaths due to air pollution in the state of Montana. In the whole U.S., there'll be on the order of 55,000. Right now, this year, according to the World Health Organization, there are about 94,000 premature air pollution deaths in the United States. And this is actually very close to our computer modeled estimate with the World Health Organization estimates. So from the 130 deaths, we, based on a statistical cost of life, which is a U.S. government, each actually values every person's life at about $8 million, unfortunately. It's not, it's an accounting. So the way they calculate this is statistical, but there are actually real costs associated with it. So it's really what people value their own life at. Like if you're willing to pay, for example, you know, $80 to reduce your chance of dying by 1 in 100,000, you're valuing your life at $8 million. Similarly, if you take a job that pays $1 an hour more, but has a higher chance of death by a certain fraction, you can then back calculate what you value your own life at. So this is what governments around the world do to value people's lives. But there are actually real costs of air pollution associated with this, with mortalities and morbidities, increased hospitalizations, increased work days lost school days, emergency room visits, higher insurance rates, higher workman's compensation rates, higher taxes that people pay. So there are a whole slew of costs associated with air pollution. But based on statistical cost of life, and then you also apply a cost of morbidity to each death to account for all the illnesses of thousands of people associated with each death, and then also account for non-health related environmental impacts. And then projecting forward to 2050, it's on the order of about $13 million a person who dies, or a little more than that. So accounting for that, we multiply through and we get $1.7 billion per year is the estimated health impact of air pollution in a business as usual case in Montana.
And can you discuss the last category of avoided costs due to the energy infrastructure change?
So all the emissions in Montana are not only pollutants that affect people's health directly, but also greenhouse gases that affect climate. And also there's some pollutants like black carbon, which is the second leading cause of global warming, that affect both climate and health. In any case, accounting for the greenhouse gas emissions, we'll call all greenhouse gas emissions from Montana, they have economists and scientists use what's called the social cost of carbon to estimate what's the global impact on the global cost impact of a ton of emissions today over 100 years. So if I emit one ton of emissions today, what's the impact on the global climate averaged over 100 years brought back to today's dollars? And that dollar amount is called the social cost of carbon. So we multiply a social cost of carbon by Montana's business as usual energy carbon dioxide and carbon dioxide equivalent emissions to estimate this number, $29 billion per year in 2050, if in a business as usual case. And if we go to wind, water, solar, we eliminate that cost.
And is that social cost of carbon that you use considered a low or a medium or a high value?
Well, we use a medium value for this estimate's based on a medium value.
Does a ton of CO2 emitted in Montana and dispersed globally harm people in Montana?
Yes.
Does the social cost of carbon account for that impact?
Yes.
Does a ton of CO2 emitted in Montana have local climate and pollution impacts as well?
Yes, indeed.
Excuse me. Objection. Foundation and that will all be good happening.
Can you explain how you came to that conclusion?
I've written two papers on it that are published in the peer review literature.
Sorry to interrupt, Your Honor, but the other thought I had was cumulative. I think this is the third or fourth witness, at least, that says finding the same thing.
So it is cumulative.
Okay. I'm moving on, Your Honor. If I could just get an answer, if the court doesn't mind, to this question, and then I'll move on to a new area.
What is this question?
Sure. Does a ton of CO2 emitted in Montana have local climate and pollution impacts as well?
Yes.
Have there been any factors that have altered your cost analysis since your 2022 U.S. paper was published?
Well, costs of wind and solar, in particular, and battery storage have declined. There's been some increases in installations of renewable energy. Those would be the primary, and there's some change in energy use.
I'd like to turn now to health benefits. In addition to the climate benefits of being on a 350 pathway, you referenced the health benefits of transitioning off of fossil fuel. Are there immediate health benefits in Montana were to reduce greenhouse gas emissions?
Yes. So this is a two-pronged answer. There's some chemicals that affect climate, like black carbon, which is the second leading cause of global warming after carbon dioxide, that affects both climate and health. Black carbon absorbs sunlight directly and is a million times more powerful than carbon dioxide per unit mass in the atmosphere. So even though it doesn't last very long in the atmosphere, its impact while it's there is very significant. And when it lands on snow or sea ice, it melts the snow or sea ice very rapidly. But it also has a significant health impact because particles cause 90% of air pollution mortality and morbidity. Worldwide, there are 7.4 million people die of air pollution each year. And as I mentioned in Montana, that's about 130 in 2050. And particles cause 90% of the mortalities. So eliminating particles that affect climate or greenhouse gases plus particles that affect climate would have an immediate benefit in that respect in terms of the immediate effects of black carbon as a particle. In fact, eliminating particles, including black carbon, will have the same day effect. Many studies have shown that when pollution concentrations increase on a given day, on that same day, there are more hospitalizations, emergency room visits, and deaths. So conversely, there are also studies showing that reducing pollution reduces immediately health impacts of air pollutants. Secondly, carbon dioxide and methane and all the other greenhouse gases, which have a global impact, also have a local impact, not only because over cities you have elevated concentrations of these pollutants, what we call carbon dioxide domes over cities, for example. And those higher concentrations of carbon dioxide over cities increase temperatures and water vapor in those cities. Temperatures and water vapor independently increase ozone, which is a chemical in smog, making that increasing health effects in cities where you already have smog. So you have this immediate local impact of higher carbon dioxide levels over cities due to the carbon dioxide dome effect.
So we have here a figure, 350 parts per million atmospheric CO2. So Dr. Jacobson, what is an additional benefit in terms of CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere of instituting your wind, water, solar plan?
Well, this graph shows the second, on the right part, the second line from the bottom, that if we transition, and this is, by the way, this was made in 2015, but it's still generally applicable. If you eliminate 80% of all emissions, this is worldwide, if you eliminate 80% of all emissions, greenhouse gases and particles affecting climate by 2030 and 100% by 2050, then the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are expected to decline on the order of 350 parts per million by the year 2100. And this is based on computer modeling that I did.
And Professor Jacobson, so if Montana were to implement the wind, water, solar roadmap you've testified about, would it be consistent with the action needed to support a return to concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere of 350 parts per million?
Yes.
I'd like to turn now to the issue of grid reliability. Would a wind, water, solar energy system developed over the next couple of decades be reliable to meet all of the energy needs of the state of Montana?
Yes, with a high degree of certainty. And I'll just say, because right now we're 92.6% of the consumption is wind, water, solar already, and the grid appears to be stable.
How did you test the reliability of the grid to make sure that it would stay stable with just wind, water, solar providing all energy for all purposes in Montana or anywhere?
So in our 2022 paper, we analyzed grid stability in each of the major grid regions of the U.S. Montana is part of the WECC region, which is basically the western U.S. And so we did a study where we converted each state in 2050 to 100% wind, water, and solar, and then did simulations at a 30-second resolution for 2 years. And we found that we can keep the grid stable throughout the West by just transferring energy between states when needed. Montana in particular is very easy because it has so much hydropower to keep the grid stable. And it also, because of these interconnections with Washington, which also has a lot of hydropower, Washington State, it is, and also Idaho, which has a lot of hydropower, Canada, which has a lot of hydropower, it's very easy to keep the grid stable in Montana.
And the, you referred to an acronym in that answer. Were you referring to the Western Electricity Coordinating Council?
Yes.
Now, can you describe a 2007 study you performed regarding the variability of when wind blows on reliable energy?
Well, this was a study where we examined, just looking at wind data in several states in the Midwest, when you start with one wind farm, you know, wind is intermittent. Wind doesn't always blow. And so there's some hours of the year you don't have any wind power at one location, and other hours you have a lot. But it turns out when the wind's not blowing in one place, it's often blowing somewhere else. So if you interconnect geographically far apart wind farms over a region that's not that big, it's over several hundred kilometers, so accompanying maybe two states in the Midwest, when you interconnected 19 wind farms, it turned out that you smooth it out, the overall supply of wind. So you actually had no hours of the year where you had no power in aggregate. And in fact, you have the same reliability, 30 to 47% of the wind is at the same reliability as a coal-fired power plant. So in other words, aggregating together geographically dispersed wind, and also applies to solar, and it also applies when you combine wind and solar, you smoothen out the variability. So you reduce the variability substantially by just interconnecting through the grid geographically far apart, wind or solar.
Are there examples of countries that have made stable electricity grids with almost all wind, water, and solar?
Yeah, there are, in fact, six countries of the world that are 100% wind, water, solar today as we speak, and there are 10 countries with more than 95% wind, water, solar. They include, well, there's Costa Rica, these are all 10, Paraguay, Iceland, Norway, Albania, Nepal, Bhutan, Ethiopia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Namibia. Now, granted, these are mostly dominated by hydropower. These are all dominated by hydropower, but they also have, some of them have certain percentages of wind and some of solar. But as I point out, I mean, Montana is 70% hydro, so it's falls right in here. with these other countries as potentially being 100% renewable.
Let's turn to the topic of energy storage as part of creating a reliable, renewable energy system. How does energy storage work when you're talking about renewable energy?
Well, there's four areas of storage. There's heat storage, cold storage, electricity storage, and hydrogen is a form of storage. Electricity storage, the main ones are conventional hydropower. There's what's called pumped hydropower, which is this picture here. Pumped hydropower is where you have two reservoirs, a lower one and an upper one. When you have extra, like when you have a lot of wind and solar on the grid, for example, if you have too much wind, then you use the extra electricity to pump water up the hill. And then you use a pump to do that. And then when you need electricity, you let the water drain down the hill and the pump runs in reverse as a generator to generate electricity. And so that you produce electricity when you need it. And then batteries, these are, well, the problem with pumped hydropower, I mean, it works great. It doesn't cost a lot and it's very efficient, but it, you know, to get it sited, it takes a few years and it's not always easy to site and zone it. Batteries, on the other hand, are pretty easy to site and zone. You know, they're costing a little more than pumped hydro right now, but they're coming down in cost of about $150 a kilowatt hour. But California now, 12% of the peak electricity in California is now provided with batteries in autumn, winter, and spring. In summer, California's electricity demand doubles, so it's about 6% in the summer. But just, I'm just pointing out the batteries are actually mainstream now, and they're being put up rapidly in many parts of the world. Hydrogen fuel cells can also be used for electricity storage. Hydrogen is also used as a form of storage, not only for electricity, but also for some long distance transportation, steel production, ammonia production will need hydrogen. And then when we have extra heat, I mean, many people have hot water tanks in their homes. That's a form of water storage, heat storage. And the nice thing about that is when you have a heat pump water heater, you don't need to heat the water when you're using it. That's why you have a tank. You can heat it when the electricity price is lower, when there's a lot of electricity on the grid. So the grid operator can actually give you an incentive to not short heat your water tank until the price of electricity is low, is when there's a low demand for electricity. So this is a way that it's grid operator can actually help keep the grid stable by just what are called smart meters and controlling it by giving people incentives, financial incentives, not to use electricity at certain times of the day. Anyway, these are all types of storage that help keep the grid stable as well.
And in one sentence, can you describe, you have the coal for purpose of energy storage. Can you quickly
get that? And so, well, I'll give an example. My university, since 1998, but it closed it in 2017, and they had a big ice cube under a building. And at night, when electricity price was low, the electricity was used to produce ice. And then during the day, in this hot summer day, instead of running air conditioning, which uses very expensive electricity, just run water through the pipes in the ice, send it to the buildings and cool the buildings. So this is like electricity storage, but it's much cheaper. Batteries, they're now $150 a kilowatt hour, and they used to be, you know, $500,000 a kilowatt hour. This was like $35 a kilowatt hour. And it's a form that you can do this with any building. A lot of stadiums have ice storage. Hospitals have ice storage when they need cold for cooling. I mean, buildings need both cold and heat for different purposes at different times.
So is your roadmap designed to keep the lights on, in essence?
Yes.
Let's also talk about land use. What's the land area required for a wind, water, solar system as opposed to oil and gas?
Well, in the state of Montana, our plans call, we're not increasing hydropower at all. We're just keeping that constant. So we're not using new land. Geothermal is really trivial. Rooftop solar does not take up new land. There's no offshore winds. So we break up the new land into what we call footprint and spacing. The footprint is mostly for utility scale solar photovoltaics, which take up land, except there are types of photovoltaics you can like raise above like an agricultural field, like 6 feet above it, and you can allow the crop to grow under it and just have the solar on top. So that allows two uses of the land, but nevertheless, this doesn't account for that. But we calculate that we would only need for our footprint for utility scale solar in Montana is 14 square miles, which is 0.01% of Montana's land area. Then in addition, we need onshore wind turbines, new wind turbines. We would need about 71 square miles. Did I say kilometers before I meant miles? But 71 square miles for this, what's the spacing area between onshore wind turbines. And that land can definitely be used for farming, agriculture, ranching, open space, or even putting solar panels on that land. But nevertheless, we're including that whole spacing area here. That's about 0.05% of Montana's land area. The total is for new land is 0.06%. Now, in comparison, which is in comparison, well, based on this reference, I didn't calculate it myself, but I looked at the reference. It says that oil and gas wells alone in their infrastructure are about 304 square miles or 0.21% of Montana's land area. I should point out that in the U.S. as a whole, the fossil fuel industry occupies about 1.3% of U.S. land area, and that includes 1.2 million active oil and gas wells, 3.2 million abandoned wells, millions of miles of gas and oil pipelines, hundreds of thousands of gas stations, their coal mines, their oil refineries, their gas storage facilities. When you add it all up, it's about 1.3% of land area. And in North America, there are 50,000 new oil and gas wells drilled every year. And they get more and more land area. Worldwide, there are 29 million abandoned oil and gas wells. And the half of these at least leak, continue to leak even after they're abandoned.
So at a bottom line level, is an electric power system based solely on hydropower, wind, and solar viable in Montana?
Yes, and storage and electric appliances and machines, yes.
Your Honor, we're going to shift into the rebuttal report of Dr. Curry, so I think this is a good point for a break.
All right. We'll take our morning recess now. We'll be in recess for 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, at the break, defendants informed us that Dr. Curry will not be called as part of their case. So the reason for the slightly longer break was to, I'm going to call it, adjust out the testimony and rebuttal to Dr. Curry. And well, first I'll stop right there. I have another matter.
Correct, Your Honor. That's what we said.
Thank you. So, Professor Jacobson, does Montana have good solar resources?
Yes, it does. And, you know, the further north you go, the more seasonal the resources are. But Montana, as you can see from this map, this is a National Renewable Energy Laboratory, NREL, map of solar resources in the United States. And the darker the color, the better the resources. Of course, Arizona, Southern California, New Mexico, parts of Texas have, you know, the best resources. But even going up to Montana, if you look at Southern Montana, you know, the colors, you can see the second shading this in Southern Montana are very similar to the resources in more Southern states, such as South Dakota, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, and West Virginia. And so there's no problem in gathering a lot of sunlight and converting it to electricity or heat. Washington State, which is, you know, just to the west of Montana, one more state over, it actually has 10 times the nameplate capacity of installed solar resources that Montana has currently. And as a result, you know, this indicates on its own that Montana has a lot of unrealized potential for solar that hasn't been installed. I'll just point out to the north of Montana, in this community, the Drake Landing solar community that I alluded to before, which is an hour south of Calgary, but north of Montana. I mean, they have these solar collectors on these roofs of these 52 homes I mentioned that collects, you know, during the summer, days are very long and you have a lot of sunlight coming and you can either convert that to heat or it can be that sunlight can be used to produce electricity. In this case, it's used to produce heat. That heat is then stored underground in soil and returned in the wintertime to these homes to heat these buildings. So there's a lot of ways you can use solar, not only for electricity generation, but also for heating, and their seasonal heat storage at very low cost. This is less than $1 per kilowatt hour of storage for this storing the summertime heat until the winter. Compared to like batteries for electricity, which are, as I mentioned, $150 a kilowatt hour. Anyway, so there is a lot of solar resource. I also point out that most people don't know this. In fact, hardly anybody knows this, that the location on Earth with the most solar resource in the annual average is the South Pole. And because if you actually track the sun, which a lot of solar panels do these days, if you track the sun, well, the sun receives 3 months of straight sunlight per year and then, you know, 3 months of darkness. But during those 3 months of sunlight, it tracks the sun and is also elevated, so it's above a lot of the air and the atmosphere that allows more sunlight to get to the panels. My only point of saying this is just because you're further north or south of the equator doesn't mean you don't have a lot of sunlight to deal with, to work with. It's more seasonal for sure, and that's where storage comes in handy. But in the case of solar at the latitude of Montana, you know, there's also solar even in the winter. There is some sunlight you can gather. That's the nice thing about solar panels. Even with low sunlight, even with clouds, you do get solar electricity. And when you don't have sunlight, you have a lot of wind. Wind and solar are anti-correlated in nature. You also have a lot of hydropower in the winter too. So just because you don't have sunlight in the winter, as much sunlight in the winter, doesn't mean you don't have renewable energy resource.
And have there been any reports prepared by the state that confirm your opinion about solar?
Yes, in general, this particular report from 2018 states that Montana has respectable solar energy potential as compared to other U.S. cities. I assume they meant states, but yes, this report seems to support that contention that there's plenty of solar in Montana.
And this is the Exhibit P9, Understanding Energy in Montana, a DEQ report as of 2018. And I move Exhibit P9 into evidence.
No objection.
P9 is submitted.
And the issue of energy insecurity has come up in this trial. Can you briefly discuss how energy insecurity is addressed by the renewable energy plan you've been discussing?
Yes, there are multiple types of energy insecurity, and so I'll try to define them. These are from my own analyses. You know, the most obvious is that, well, fossil fuels are resources, and so is uranium, and they will run out at some point. And at that point, or before that point, you'll see rises in prices and economic, social, and political instability. So that's a type of energy insecurity that's going to happen. And so at some point, we would need to transition, even if we weren't today. And so if we can transition ahead of that point, then that would avoid that energy insecurity. So transitioning to wind, water, solar will avoid this first energy insecurity. The second is the reliance on centralized power plants and oil refineries and other facilities. You know, if you have a big coal-fired power plant and it goes down, then you're taking down a big portion of the city's electricity grid. Or if it's an oil refinery, you take down a lot of the production of oil. That can lead to a big price spike. Well, with wind and solar in particular, these are what we call distributed energy sources. They're more spread out. You have a lot of individual wind turbines and a lot of individual solar panels and systems. Even rooftop solar system on somebody's home is one system. And by having these distributed energy resources, that reduces the chance that if there's, you know, it's hard to take down, even if it's a bad actor or terrorist or something, it's hard to take down a whole wind farm. You take down a few turbines, but not a whole wind farm very easily. And same with distributed solar energy. So that's another way that renewable energy resources, particularly wind and solar, can help to provide some energy security. Then right now, a lot of locations on Earth, a lot of countries in particular, but also states, rely on the transfer of fossil fuels through pipelines or barges or ships across international boundaries. And this can lead to energy insecurity because some countries control the energy of other countries, especially in times of conflict, or it could be just internal strife, or it could be a strike where you have a disruption of a supply of energy. And this applies a lot to fossil fuels. Now, with renewables, you know, our plans are all designed so that each state and country can, in the annual average, provide its own power for all purposes. But, you know, to keep the grid stable is often beneficial to share with your neighbors, share electricity with your neighbors. But it's not, you don't have to go necessarily very far to do that. And anyway, we think that by these plans really minimize the transfers of energy across political boundaries and so reduce that energy insecurity associated with, for example, you know, drilling for oil in a different country and having to transport it long distances to other countries. And also high prices. I mean, the state with the highest electricity price in the U.S. is Hawaii, and it's because they have to have all their oil, which is how most of our electricity is generated from oil, is shipped across the ocean. And so there's a lot of high shipping costs. In fact, all, you know, the price of electricity there is like 35, 38 cents a kilowatt hour. If you go to the Caribbean or American Samoa, we're talking like 50 cents a kilowatt hour for electricity. It's the same thing. And so our plans also involve making these island countries or states energy independent and reducing their electricity costs. And finally, fossil fuels have mining, air pollution, and other types of catastrophic risks associated with them. When I say mining, continuous fuel mining. All energy has some mining for infrastructure, has mining for infrastructure, but there's continuous fuel mining, and there's a lot of problems associated with that, like black lung disease with coal mining, with leaks, with natural gas, hydrofracking, for example, underground air pollution, breathing the air. With uranium, there's underground uranium mining leads to excess lung cancers due to radon, the decays to polonium, and people breathing polonium. In any case, we eliminate most of the mining associated with energy by going to these renewable energy plants.
Speaking of mining, what are the mining needs of fossil fuels compared to renewables?
Yeah, so there's a lot of criticism of renewables because, you know, for batteries, you need lithium, or you might need some rare earths like neodymium for permanent magnets and wind turbine generators, and certain solar panels require certain materials. But if you look at the big picture, the mining that's going on today is orders of magnitude that which we'll need with a clean renewable energy future. Sure, we will need mining for lithium, for rare earths, and for other materials, but it's much, much less. Because we only need that mining to build the infrastructure, not to provide fuel every single day of every year. And as I've talked about already, you know, we have 50,000 new oil and gas wells drilled every year in North America and 1.3 million active ones in the U.S. alone. And this has to go on forever if we want to keep going with natural gas and fossil fuels. Now, with regard to mining, we reduce lithium. People are concerned with lithium. Well, first of all, batteries are being recycled now. So, like, I'll give you an example. There's a company, Sonnen, and they build batteries that last, they're warranted for 15 years, 15,000 cycles, and they recycle 100% of their batteries. So once you produce that battery, that lithium can be recycled and used in another battery or something else. Or you can take a battery that's used in a car and then use it for grid electricity storage, because even after you can't use it in the car, any longer, it's still useful. There's still a lot of life left in it for other purposes. And not only is there recycling, but give you an example, like the Salton Sea in Southern California has enough lithium underneath, by one study projected, that it could supply 40% of all the world's lithium needs. And already there's geothermal electricity production on the Salton Sea, where they bring up a brine of hot, basically hot salt and water, and they use it to power, to provide electricity, but that same brine contains lithium, and so you can extract the lithium from that brine without any additional mining. Anyway, point is there are also, if there's a shortage of some material, there's often another option for, so you don't need to use that material anymore for some purposes, like neodymium for permanent magnets, for example. There's, you know, there's another type of material that's even stronger than neodymium that could be substituted in. Anyway, the point is mining, even though there'll still be mining, there's going to be a lot less mining than we currently have.
And can you specifically address the issue of coal mining?
Yeah, so there's this one study that's referred to at the bottom of this link, or the bottom of this page here, that they examined replacing a gigawatt of coal production of electricity with 1 gigawatt with a wind production of electricity, and they found that it saved 25 million tons of coal mining, of material, basically all coal, over a 20-year time frame. And this just illustrates that, yeah, you'll still need mining to produce wind turbines, but because you're eliminating the continuous mining for fuel, there's a huge reduction of total material mined over a 20-year time frame.
And earlier you talked about health issues and the like. By the way, what I'm displaying is Plaintiff's Exhibit P118. And this paper is entitled On the Causal Link Between Carbon Dioxide and Air Pollution Mortality. You earlier spoke about the issue of mortality. Is this one of your published papers that have been peer-reviewed on that issue?
Yes.
And can you quickly summarize your conclusion from this paper?
Yeah, this paper found that higher temperatures resulting from greenhouse gases, or it could be for any cause, could cause the higher temperatures, but in this particular case, we're looking at higher temperatures caused by greenhouse gases. Well, they would trigger also more water vapor in the air because higher temperatures cause more water to evaporate from the soil or from the ocean. So you have both higher temperatures and water vapor, and both independently increase ozone, which is the main component, one of the main components of air pollution in polluted urban areas. They both independently increase ozone when ozone is already elevated. So higher temperatures and higher water vapor triggered by higher carbon dioxide, or it could be methane, or it could be nitrous oxide, any of the greenhouse gases, or do something else, will increase ozone for a chemical reason, if due to the higher temperatures and higher water vapor independently.
And you also wrote a paper in 2010 entitled Enhancement of Local Air Pollution by Urban Carbon Dioxide Domes. Is that correct?
Yes.
And again, very briefly, can you explain your conclusion in this paper?
So in this paper, we looked at, well, there are measurements in cities around the world, but a lot in the U.S., showing higher concentrations of carbon dioxide in urban areas because you have a higher concentration of cars and other sources. So you get like the background level of carbon dioxide is 420 parts per million. But in some of these cities, you get 500, 600 plus parts per million in the air. And well, at that level, you know, breathing in the carbon dioxide is not going to cause direct health problems, but you do get slightly from based on computer modeling, which is the only way you can tease this out. You do get higher temperatures, slightly higher temperatures in these cities, urban areas with the higher levels of carbon dioxide, these domes. And based on that, because you get higher temperatures, you also then get higher water vapor, and those both independently increase ozone and air pollution as discussed in the previous paper. And so we found that over the United States, a 1 degree rise in temperature was estimated to increase the air pollution death rate by about 1,000 per year. I think the background death rate was on the order of 75,000, although I don't remember. Well, it's probably in there, but I don't even remember the exact number.
Okay. Professor Jacobson, let's talk about what could have happened with renewable energy historically in Montana. When, in your opinion, could the energy transition have occurred?
Well, it certainly could have started as early as the 1970s, but certainly by the 1980s to 1990s. I mean, it's, you know, Montana is well known to have amazing wind resources, you know, way back in the 70s and even earlier. Just anybody who lives there should know that it has a really good wind resource. And wind turbines, you know, have been around, well, I mean, they've been around since 1890 or so, but, you know, the first wind farm in the world was built, the first three were built in around 1979, 1982. And so at least shortly after that, it would have been logical to start building wind farms in Montana. You know, solar resources are also known, and solar panels, of course, they really started taking off in the 1990s. And so by the 1990s, it would have been reasonable to assume that there would have been a growth of solar in Montana as well. Hydroelectric power resources have been well developed for a long time in Montana. So they've already been that resource has already grown. But wind and solar in particular, I think that starting in the 1980s, at least should have taken off with respect to wind in the 1990s with respect to solar.
I'm displaying here a 1975 report, Plaintiff's Exhibit P37, entitled Montana Energy Policy Study, Environmental Quality Council, and it's the Environmental Quality Council of the Montana State Legislature. Did you review this and the course of your work on this case?
Yes.
And, Your Honor, I'd move Exhibit P37 into evidence.
Objection as to relevance.
Your Honor, he's going to quote on the what I'm going to call the Montana's knowledge of alternative energy back in 1975. Briefly quote from that and explain the quote, and then we'll move on.
I'm going to refuse P37 on relevance grounds.
Okay. What would have happened had Montana's government promoted a climate-safe energy policy at that time rather than approving every fossil fuel project for the past five decades?
Objection, both to the form of the question as leading, argumentative, and also as to relevance.
I don't think it's argumentative, but I'll let you ask it. Go ahead. You can ask.
Well, I think there would have been more growth of wind and solar and more openness to electrification and less ingrained infrastructure of fossil fuels. And the fact that you have such an ingrained infrastructure of fossil fuels, it makes it more difficult to transition, although it's definitely possible. It takes longer and makes it more difficult.
So, in conclusion, Professor Jacobson, can you please summarize your opinions on the feasibility of transitioning the state of Montana to 100% clean, renewable energy in all sectors by mid-century or earlier?
Yes. Well, I think it is definitely technically and economically possible to transition Montana for all energy purposes to run on wind, water, and sunlight, as we call it, which also includes geothermal electricity too, although very small amounts. By 2035 to 2050, and ideally with 80% by 2030, of course, to get 80% by 2030, very strong policy measures would be needed. A natural transition is likely to occur just due to the low cost of everything that's related to this. But you have such an ingrained infrastructure that it's necessary, I believe, in my opinion, to enhance policies, enhance wind, water, solar type policies to speed up that transition. But I do think it's technically and economically feasible and significantly economically beneficial. And I think such a transition is really the best and only way to really address the climate, air pollution, energy security problems the world faces. But I should say that, it really requires all countries and states to do this simultaneously. It's, one place on its own is, going to have impact, will have local impacts and benefits. But to solve the climate problem on a global scale, everybody needs to act simultaneously. And I think, there are other proposals moving forward that people have proposed, but I think this electrification and providing electricity with clean renewable energy provides the greatest benefit in the shortest amount of time and with the least collateral damage. And it not only, such a transition would not only address the climate problem, but also provide more energy security than the current energy infrastructure and reduce air pollution, which the current energy infrastructure is causing. And as I mentioned, it's technically and economically feasible to transition Montana off fossil fuel and supply its needs with just wind and water and solar power for all energy purposes. the barrier, the main barrier I see is that we need collective willpower, and that requires governments, not only state governments, but local governments, individuals, local governments, state governments, and national governments to work together towards this goal. It requires collective willpower along in many fields and sectors. It involves science, business, culture, and community. And I mean, you know, I do science, but nobody listens to me. It's just, but it really, you know, working together with other people, this is how we affect the change by providing I provide information based on all the work that we've done over the last decades. But it requires collective willpower. So I think policies are needed to affect the transition.
Do you have an opinion, Professor Jacobson, on what would happen to clean, what would have happened if clean and renewable energy in all sectors of Montana, if Montana was required to consider the true costs of fossil fuel energy systems in its decision making?
So the economics is based on, in terms of energy, is based on energy costs plus externality costs, which include in this case air pollution and climate costs. So if policies were actually based on economics, then there would be no more fossil fuel growth in Montana or any other state or country, because you're counting for the pollution and climate impacts, and those are so enormous that there would be no competition in terms of costs with clean renewable energy systems.
And do you have an opinion of what would happen, and from a scientific perspective, if Montana's laws were that allow for the or promote fossil fuel development and use were declared unconstitutional?
Objection, irrelevant. Promotion is not that issue in this case.
Rephrase, please.
Professor Jacobson, do you have an opinion that if Montana's laws were that allow for the utilization of fossil fuel development, particularly under statutes such as MEPA, were declared unconstitutional, what would happen?
There would
be cause for legal conclusion.
I believe there would be a faster transition to clean renewable energy. I should point out that, you know, some states that have 9 out of the 10 states in the U.S. with the most wind power as a fraction of their electricity consumption are all states that have few policies supporting it because of the economics of it, the economics of wind power. And so there is going to be a natural transition to wind and solar just because they're low cost. But the key is, if you want to actually meet if you want to actually solve the problems of pollution and climate and energy security rapidly, you need a more rapid transition than a natural transition will result in. And that requires aggressive policies to be put in place.
And that rapid transition to 100% renewable energy system, would that be acting consistent with a pathway back to CO2 of 350 parts per million?
Yes, especially if we can get 80% transition by 2030 and 100% by 2035 to 2050, I believe so.
Thank you, Professor Jacobson. I have no further questions.
Cross?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, Professor Jacobson.
Good morning.
I'd like to, you've talked a lot about some pretty esoteric stuff. So I'd like to back this up to some more basic topics. And so I want to ask you this. When we flip the light switch on for this courtroom, what mix of energy sources turns that electricity on?
Well, since Montana is connected to the entire Western grid, it's impossible to tell.
Okay.
So, but on most of the electricity just proportionally, since its proximity to Montana, is coming from Montana. So of the there's generation and then there's consumption. The numbers I gave before were for consumption of electricity, but what's generated is slightly different. So there's also a bunch of, there's a lot of fossil fuels in addition to the renewables being generated. And I don't know
if I could paraphrase then, when we flip on the light switch in this courtroom, we can't know. We could figure it out, I suppose, but we don't know. You don't know. How much of it is fossil fuel? How much of it is hydro at any particular time?
I can make an educated guess, but it's hard to know exactly. Yeah, because all the electrons mix onto the grid. I mean, if Montana was isolated, then we could tell more precisely. But there's some imports and exports going on at the same time.
Sure, Montana is not isolated. Montana is part of the Western Energy control over the grid, right?
Correct.
And so there's actually, I'm trying to ask about two aspects, the source, the kind of energy that's being produced that comes here to help turn on the electricity and where it comes from, which is a separate question. Do you understand
what?
Yeah. So, and where it comes from, is also controlled by the Western Energy planners and people that are flipping switches somewhere, right?
Yeah. If there's a lack of electricity production in Montana, then there's going to be a net flow into the Montana. If there's too much electricity in Montana, there's going to be flow out. And that's kind of really what's controlled by these importers and exporters.
And so let me ask about the Western Electricity Coordinating Council. There are quite a few Western states that are included as members. I don't know if that's the right words, but involved with that, correct?
Yes.
I mean, we're talking basically the whole Western United States, aren't we?
Yes. Yeah, pretty much all the states going straight south and to the west.
And so from a practical standpoint, I'm picturing, tell me if this is wrong, that there's somebody within the Western Energy Coordinating Council has the ability to decide where power is going, where it's being shifted to and from in the West at any given time. Is that true?
I think it's more complicated. I think there's some contractual arrangements where it's predetermined, and then a lot depends on what's the actual supply or demand at a given moment. So it's where's the least congestion? Like if you have some grid somewhere that's really congested, you're probably not going to get electricity from there.
As one example, that might be one congestion. What about let's take a hot summer day. Let's say it's boiling hot in Washington and Oregon, and it's not so much here. Would energy from Montana be shifted out there to drive air conditioners or vice versa? Is that kind of balancing out why the Western Energy Coordinating Council exists?
Well, I think a summer example might be, I live in California. I know in California we have twice the electricity demand. And so I think during summer, there's some electricity from Montana and and other Western states shifted to California because we have a lot of imports in summer. So it might happen in Washington, although I doubt it happens. I think Washington's more of a net exporter because it has so much hydropower. And I'm doubting it actually sends a lot this way as opposed to the other.
But I guess the point I'm trying to make, and tell me if you disagree with this, Montana is not in control of its own fate when it comes to decisions about where its energy goes, right?
I think there's some control, but there's also in the end about, since it's part of this interconnect, that's a higher priority, but I think there is some control. I'm not entirely certain how it operates within Montana in terms of the control it has.
And the reason that all these states are part of the Western electricity coordinating council is for grid stability, is it not?
Yes.
Because you're spreading around the sources of power and then the ability to move it around to take care of whatever the many factors that might go into that decision, right?
Yes, correct.
Your opinion overall has been that we can be carbon neutral, for lack of a better word, or free of fossil fuels by 2050, and that that's feasible.
Yes.
I'd like to ask you about feasibility. Are you using the word feasible the same as the word possible? Are you equating those terms?
No. I mean, feasible, I think impossible is it may happen or may not happen, whereas feasible, it can be done technically and economically. And I think it's really a question of whether we decide we want to do it.
And when you say we, are you
collectively
goes into that?
In the state of Montana, if Montana decides, if the state government decides that they want to go to set a policy to go to 100% clean renewable energy for all its generation and transportation and buildings and industry, that's in the the state can do that on its own. I mean, if they collectively decide they want to do that.
Yeah, the government could decide to do that, but it wouldn't be possible to actually get to the goal of fossil-free energy by 2050 if Montana did it on its own, right?
It is technically, it's possible to do it for generation in the state. You're asking the question of will Montana's grid be fossil-free? That's a different question in my mind.
Well, right. I mean, I'm asking whether the grid stability, the generation through wind, solar, the entire mix could be to where we are fossil fuel free by 2050. If Montana was the only state among its neighbors that decided to do that.
First, I think there are other states in the West, many of them, on average, all the states in the Western U.S. are on the order of 50% in their electric power sector, 50% wind, water, and solar. California is 50%. Washington State is 98% in its consumption. Idaho is one of the top states, 73%. And this is just an electric power sector. Of course, we're talking about all sectors. So I actually did this analysis. I looked at all the states, and on average, because I was interested how much electricity that's being imported to California, which is all the Western states, is wind, water, solar, and it was on the order of 50%. It was already wind, water, solar, right, this year, 2023.
Well, again, let's back up a little bit. To be fossil fuel free means, for example, that farms and ranches in Montana and everybody would be driving EVs, electric vehicles, right?
Yes.
No more internal combustion engines.
Correct.
And so to have this happen, are we saying the judge is going to give everybody the money to buy a Ford Lightning? How does it work? How is it that ranches and farms and citizens of Montana will be able to buy, even if they're available, the equipment, the stoves, the heaters, everything that's driven with fossil fuels by 2050, even if the government orders them to do it?
Well, it's straightforward, actually, because, first of all, a vehicle has a typical lifetime of 15 years. So, like, California has a law now through a governor's executive order and also through the California Resources Board that no car sold after 2034, so starting in 2035, every car has to be zero emission And so that means the only, and they even state the only vehicles that can be sold are battery electric vehicles or hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicles, or there's a plug-in electric hybrid, which I'm not sure what that is exactly, but it's in terms of what's the hybrid part. But that's stating that there will be no ethanol vehicles, gasoline vehicles, diesel vehicles sold in California, which is the biggest market in 2035. And it's a gradual phase out and transition. So they're doing it. Every other state can do it. And already, I mean, Norway, 70% of all cars sold last year were electric. And, you know, the country is going to be fully electric vehicles, and they're way further north than Montana and ICE. And this is, and, but it's going to save people money. So if it's not going to, there's an upfront cost doing everything, but it'll save money over time. As I talked about, it'll save $30 billion over 15 years if everybody in Montana drove an electric vehicle. And these are, this is money in everybody's pocket. So I don't think anybody will be complaining. People who actually transition to electric vehicles, they love them because of the acceleration, they're lower maintenance, they're safe, more safe because they're lower weight, and they have more craft space. Their center of gravity is lower. That's why they don't roll. And, you know, they might right now, there's a higher upfront cost, but notwithstanding that it's also covered under the $7,500 tax credit for the most part that you can still receive for an electric vehicle, you save way more than that. Individually, each car owner will save in Montana $35,000 over 15 years with this car. So the car would have to be $35,000 more for it not to be beneficial.
So you think a person living on fixed income in central Montana can walk into a Ford dealership, get an F-150 Lightning, and have money in their pocket? Is that what you're saying? It sounds like it.
I'm saying that over the next time that somebody needs to buy a car, because that's, again, it's a transition. So the policy would not necessarily be today that they have to switch, but like if your car is going to, your average life is 15 years, over 15 years, sometime you're going to need a new car. And the next car, instead of buying a gasoline or diesel car or flex fuel car, you buy an electric car. That makes the transition smoother. And then it also helps, especially for low-income people, the government would ideally help more to encourage this transition because it will save them money in the long run. They will get money back very immediately. Because immediately they're, I mean, some people pay $100 a week for gas. I mean, you're suddenly going to go down to $25 a week if you're paying $100 a week.
Do you know how much it costs to buy a new totally electric or even a hybrid pickup truck today in Montana?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Ford one F-150, the Lightning, was on the order of $65,000 or $70,000, I believe. But the equivalent gasoline version was also similar to that. You can find cheaper ones that are like two-wheel drive, six-cylinder, that are like $35,000-$40,000. But to get the equivalent one, and this is early days in these, there's also Rivian, there's all the other electric truck companies. But, you know, you can get a Chevy Bolt if your goal is to get from one place to another. Chevy Bolt, you can get that for, you know, $30,000-$35,000. And it'll also save you money over time compared to a gasoline vehicle.
And so is it your opinion that the court should order citizens of Montana to buy electric vehicles?
I mean, I don't know. I'm not going to speak for the court.
Well, I don't want to either. But we're talking about feasibility.
Yeah.
And actually, feasibility, I think you'd agree, is different than possibility. Possibility is more theoretical. Feasibility means it can be, it's more easily done. It's within the realm of reality.
I mean, if you can buy any vehicle, you can buy an electric vehicle. And things are getting better every year. So, okay, you can argue in some cases some new cars are more expensive, and they do have, again, the $7,500 tax credit to kind of even out the upfront cost. But every year, these costs are coming down. In fact, well, Tesla just dropped its prices for their cars because materials suddenly dropped, lithium suddenly became more abundant. And then then the prices dropped for the Model Y. I don't know. There's quite a bit. But prices of electric cars are going down, especially as they get purchased more and more, just due to economies of scale. The more you sell them, cars, their costs come down.
And you testified, you were asked about a decision by the court to declare the NEPA provision that we're arguing about unconstitutional. And if the court were to do that, that would facilitate us getting to no fossil fuels by 2050, in your opinion?
Yeah, so, well, it would be one step toward that goal.
Isn't it a fact that your plan or your roadmap for Montana, and this would be true for any state, it has interdependent elements? For example, the energy mix that we would have to rely on. A portion of it is hydro. And if for some reason there was a problem with hydro, we'd have a problem with the plan. So are you with me so far?
Well, I don't think you're going to have a problem with hydro.
That wasn't my question. Okay. Yeah. This is hypothetical, and you're well-equipped to answer hypotheticals.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
If hydro became a problem for whatever reason, then the plan doesn't work.
No, that's not the case, because every state, first of all, has a different plan from every other state. It's a different mix. So, yeah.
You're talking about Montana.
Okay. Montana, you have plenty of wind and you have battery storage, hydrogen fuel cells, solar. Yeah, if there's zero hydro in Montana, you can run it 100% renewable, no problem.
With the flip of a switch?
No, with a proper planning and build out.
Well, are you aware, for example, that the main stem dams in Montana, Hungry Horse and Libby Dam, the operation of those dams are in large part controlled by a federal court in Portland, Oregon. Okay. Are you aware of that, sir?
No.
And let's back up a little bit. We talk about energy generation from hydropower. We're not, for example, talking about water that goes over the top of the dam or that's spilled around the edge of the dam. It has to go through the turbines in the dam to generate the power, right?
Correct.
And so that the dam operator has the ability to control how much water is going through those turbines at any given time, correct?
Correct.
And the decisions that the dam operator makes at any given time about how much water to go through their turbines to generate electricity, that's what I'm getting at. What factors go into that decision on generation from any particular hydro facility at any given time? Do you know?
Well, it's a matter of policy. Now, if it's in state, you're saying it's controlled through Portland. So are you talking about if it's controlled in the state of Montana?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I didn't mean to. I'm asking you, and let's just take, Libby Dam, for example, in northwestern Montana on the Kootenai River, that's operated by the Corps of Engineers. They can do the buttons or whatever it takes to decide how much water goes through the turbines and how much power to generate. What factors at any given time go into that decision that the dam operator is making?
Well, currently, I mean, they consider flow rates, they consider fish, I don't know about this particular dam, but general fish, they can consider, you know, water, how much is needed for water supply and farming, or you don't want to have too much water going down the river at some time. So there are a lot of factors that go into these decisions. But all these factors are based on policies that can be adjusted over time to ensure a reliable grid. If your number one priority is to keep the grid stable, then you'd adjust the policies to ensure that happens. So it's just because you have existing policies now that are based on certain criteria because there hasn't been a concern about, you know, keeping the grid stable because there's not a problem. If there is a problem that arises, then there is the ability to adjust those policies to change the priorities.
Well, let's say the policies include fish, and they include, hypothetically, and this isn't actually a hypothetical, they include sending water downstream for salmon in the Columbia River. There may be policies, there may be laws about that. Are those controlled by the state of Montana, which is the decision we have to wrestle with here today?
Objection, you are a cultural legal conclusion.
It's a factual question.
Well, he's setting forth a fact pattern. If you can answer, if you can't.
Well, I think if it's in state, you're not talking something at the border with a different state. Or, I mean, if it's flowing in a state, I think the state has control over that. But maybe I can cut through. I said, let's say you can't even get any water from that dam or hydroelectricity from that dam. First of all, a lot of Montana's hydropower comes from Canada. It's imported from Canada. And, you know, there's imports from Washington State, there's from Idaho. And there's so much resource potential in Montana. Yeah, if you have trouble with one resource, fortunately you have the ability to shift to a different resource. Sometimes you have to oversize too. In fact, to keep the grid stable, it's often cheaper, instead of buying storage, it's cheaper to like build more wind turbines, build more solar panels than you need. So if something like that happens, you have backup. That's sometimes cheaper than buying storage, or you can do a combination. In all cases, even if you had to overbuild and buy an extra storage, it's so much less expensive to Montana to transition than to keep the current infrastructure. It's 69% lower cost. You could double the amount of wind. You can waste half your wind, double the infrastructure, and it'll still be cheaper. So you're talking about trivialities in my mind. It's obviously important at the dam level, but in the context of a transition, this is minutia in my mind. This is a distraction from the actual issue, because you can not use that dam at all and still have 100% renewable system if it's planned properly.
Well, I guess I'd like to ask if we could have an agreement on this, Dr. Jacobson. When you say for any of these topics that we can do this, we can do that, I'd like to ask you to agree that when you say we, it's Montana citizens, the Montana legislature or courts in Montana. We're not here to talk about what Idaho can do or what Canada can do.
No.
And so can you restrict your answers to that, or tell us, if the transition, for example, requires more than just Montana making decisions. It requires Canada, Idaho, California, Arizona, the Western Energy Coordinating Council, and so on to make it happen. Okay.
Well, yes, I agree. When I say we, I don't mean I'm part of Montana that I'm making decisions, but yeah, it's definitely in the state of Montana's hands. Each state can only do what they can do. So they just can do the best they can. And in Montana's case, Montana has the ability to control its own production. It has the ability to control in laws or set control what other states do. The best you can do is control what you're doing, what Montana is doing in the state.
And even assuming Montana has control over those things and exercises it in the ways that you'd like and a lot of other people would like to see Montana do, you're not going to get fossil fuel free by 2050 unless the other entities, people, governments that are connected to this system make similar decisions, right?
No, I disagree, because even if the fossil fuel, if the electricity coming onto your grid, onto Montana's grid from out of state is produced from some fossil fuel electricity, that wasn't emitted in Montana.
But what if it isn't? I mean, you just answered my question about the interconnection between getting to fossil fuel free in 2050 and other entities besides the state of Montana. You said, I think, if the energy coming in is fossil fuel free, then we don't have a problem. That gets us, helps get us to where we are.
Well, I mean, our plans are based on each state generating 100% of its energy, eliminating all emissions in the state,
right,
which is eliminating air pollution emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, and by transitioning and therefore providing energy security. Whether it imports, quote, dirty electricity from out of state is something, A, that's out of your control, and, or it might be in your control, you might be able to stop it at the border by just cutting off the transmission line, but it's also in the parameters of our plans where we're looking at each state transitioning, you're meeting the requirements by making all your own sources 100% renewable. Of course, our plans involve all states doing the same thing, but in the event that it doesn't happen in another state, it still meets the parameters of our plan.
Yeah, I think you can just answer my question.
Okay.
Thanks. You said that there was, to get to this point of fossil fuel free by 2050 wouldn't require a change in any on the part of the citizens of Montana. Is that, did I accurately?
Correct. I mean, you're not going to lose your quality of life, will not go down. In fact, I think it'll improve because you'll have healthier air inside your home, more efficient appliances, so you spend less on energy.
Would you agree that Montana is a relatively rural state?
Yeah, on average, yes.
Have you visited central or eastern Montana?
Yes.
And so you're familiar with the large ranches, wide open spaces, and that kind of thing?
Yes.
And wouldn't it be true that a rancher out there in the hinterlands of Montana is going to have to make a decision in order to make this plan work about the kind of vehicles he or she has, the way that their home is powered, along that's connected with other folks too. So their behavior would include having them voluntarily or otherwise make some decisions about how they live their lives that they're not having to consider today, correct?
You definitely need to make purchases or do retrofits, or if you're building a new home, make decisions. But I was referring to the quality of life once those decisions are made and then as they're implemented.
But I think you used the word behavior. Did you mean to use that word, or was that misspoken?
What's the sentence?
You said that there could be no, there were this getting to where we want to be fossil fuel free by 2050 mm-hmm. would not require a change in behavior of people in Montana. I think we can go look it up. That's what you said.
That's fine. No, I said that. What I meant by change of behavior is you're not going to have to get blankets because you're too cold in the winter because the heating doesn't work. You're still going to be able to drive, drive to where you want to go. You're going to be able to cook just like you could cook before. You can turn on your light bulb and you won't notice a difference. I mean, just to give an example of what I mean, I built from scratch an all electric home, no gas. And I don't notice any difference except it's even more comfortable, perfect temperature. So I don't have to before, in fact, I was getting cold because the temperature wasn't adjusting correctly and I'd have to get a blanket or something like that. Now the temperature is perfect. Never have a light bulb go out. And it's actually better. I mean, I just don't know how else to describe it. So by behavior, I meant in your normal daily activities, you're not going to really notice. It's going to be like a seamless transition. Sure, there's effort to actually go through the transition. Of course, if the state built a bunch of new buildings that are all already electrified, then people can just walk into them and they won't even have to do that. But sure, existing homeowners would have to make an effort to, which will be beneficial to weather seal their homes, to reduce energy use, change their light bulbs to LED lights.
So if your daily routine involves hauling cattle to market, hauling hay, cutting hay, seeding a field, applying herbicides or pesticides with a tractor, that they won't see any difference in the way they live their lives?
I think there's some technologies that may not be available quite yet to do some of these activities, like in the same way, but they're coming if they're not here. There's no, many of them, we have electric tractors, we have electric, you know, we have electric trucks, we have electric farm, different types of farm equipment, construction equipment, but, you know, whether it's commercial or not, that people want to buy yet, some of them are not, maybe not be available yet, but they will be in the next few years.
Do your calculations about the extent to which Montana uses fossil fuel include transportation modes of various kinds?
Yes.
That include railroads, for example?
Yes.
And so, or how about air travel?
Yes.
And so to get to where you feel, and like I say, many people feel we ought to be, somehow Montana has to ensure that airlines that fly over the state are not using fossil fuels.
Again, it's what can Montana control. So airlines are more federal, so I wouldn't say that Montana even has jurisdiction. I'm not 100% sure. There might be some local small planes or something. But there are electric small planes already flying and commercial. In fact, SAS Airlines is already selling seats for their commercial flights all electric commercial flights.
Did you factor into your report in terms of either the totals that are the total energy sources that are being utilized today, what Montana does not have control over, like, for example, federal jurisdiction? Is that in the mix here somewhere?
Well, we included transition for everything that the EIA assigned to Montana. So whether some of that can be controlled, you know, I can't say 100%.
How many wind turbines, and I know it would be probably dependent on their generating capacity, but you could factor that in. Mm-hmm. Would it take to generate 1 gigawatt of electrical energy?
Well, the average capacity factor, which is the fraction of the annual fraction of the what's called the rated power of a wind turbine that's actually realized over a year. So it's basically, you know, if you have a wind turbine that's rated at, say, 10 megawatts, and it generates on average over the year 5 megawatts, then it has a capacity factor of 50%. So the average capacity of all wind turbines built between 2014 and 2021 in the United States, according to the Department of Energy through the Lawrence Berkeley Lab, was about 38.5%. So just rounded to 40%. So if you want to generate 1 gigawatt of electric power, you need 2.5 gigawatts of nameplate capacity of wind.
Okay. And how many wind turbines would it require to do that?
It depends on the nameplate capacity of the individual turbines. I mean, right now, the largest wind farm in the world is just being completed off the coast of the Netherlands. And those turbines are each 11 megawatts. GE produces a 15 megawatt turbine. These are more for offshore wind, but let's say it's take a 5 megawatt wind turbine, which is could be pretty standard for onshore wind. But so divide 25 by 5, so you need about 500. Yeah, so for 5 megawatt.
5 megawatt turbines to generate 1 gigawatt.
No, 2.5 gigawatt. Oh, to generate 1 gigawatt of electricity, but 2.5 gigawatts of nameplate capacity.
All right. And to generate 1 gigawatt, then you'd need 4 times that amount.
No, that's to generate 1 gigawatt of electricity.
Okay.
Is 500, 5 megawatts.
500 turbines, roughly.
Yeah.
And have you done any studying on where we would site five? Well, we have existing wind power, but I think in the discussion you had with council, you were talking about replacing how much fossil fuel would be replaced by 1 gigawatt of wind energy, right?
I mean, I could tell you exactly how much wind we proposed for Montana, if that's what you want to get out.
Well, sure. Let's start there.
There's in this report on table 4, 4.5 gigawatts nameplate capacity.
That we would need to...
To provide the portion, the wind's portion of Montana for 100% renewable Montana.
Okay. Say that again.
4.5 gigawatts.
4.5 gigawatts. And we just said we would take 500 wind turbines for 1 gigawatt.
No, for 4.5 gigawatts of nameplate capacity, which would, let's round that to 5 gigawatts for simplicity. That would give you 2 gigawatts of delivered electricity.
Well, I'm not a math guy, so let me ask you this. If you know how many wind turbines at, say, the largest, you know, that you described, if that's hypothetical use, would we need to produce that amount that you're recommending in your report?
Well, if they're 5 megawatt turbines, it'd be 1,000 5 megawatt wind turbines.
Okay. That's what I was wondering.
And then we calculated the land area to be about 0.05% of Montana's land area.
Because Montana is a large state, right?
That helps.
If you're doing a percentage, the bigger the state, the smaller the percentage, true?
Correct. I mean, we try to make sure, there's some really small states that it would take, bigger percentages.
But in this plan, there's a huge social question. Right. Because whether you're talking about behavior or the will politically or
anything,
it's people. The bottom line is people have to want to go here to make it work. Right.
True.
And so part of that social equation would be judgments made about putting 1,000 new wind turbines in Montana. Some people have different opinions about that. I'm sure that's part of the mix. One part that supports your plan, correct?
Yes. Well, that applies to any energy infrastructure, like wells, drilling wells. But, farmers tend to like it because they get a royalty.
Well, but that varies widely, doesn't it, from company to company? Depends on who's putting the wind and power in.
I don't want to profess to know a lot about it, but I do know that because it's like basically, because a wind turbine is basically a pole on the ground that hardly takes up any land on the ground. And so farmers can actually farm around it. So they not only get the money from their crop, it's basically an additional income worth sacrificing, hardly a little bit of land, for the roads accessing. But it's very little land and you just get additional income. So this is all states throughout. This is why there's such a wind energy boom throughout the Great Plains.
Have you talked to any farmers in Montana about the factors that they consider when they're negotiating a wind farm lease or being asked to negotiate a wind farm lease?
No.
No further questions. Thank
you.
Any redirect?
No redirect, Your Honor, made. Professor Jacobs would be excused.
Yes, certainly. Thank you very much.
Thank you.